All right, it's time to change gears a little bit. Slip into some blues here. For all of you investors out there who might be feeling the blues these days, trying to raise capital, well, you don't have to feel that way. There is a show now that you can turn to, the Private Investing and Business Hour, right here on OC Talk Radio, where we give you some inside information that you need to know from the insiders themselves who are out there investing in companies, looking for opportunities and making deals. Venture capitalists, angel investors, all sorts of people. Brought to you by the folks at CalCap Partners. With your hosts, a man that knows way more about this than I'll ever, Jim Butts from CalCap Partners. Hey, Jim, how are you?
Well, thanks, Paul. And joining me today is Jay Goff. Jay is the founder of Redtail Capital. He's over in the Inland Empire type area. And he's doing some interesting things, both in terms of companies and finding investments and finding them investable and making them investable. So welcome to the show, Jay.
Thanks, Jim. Happy to be here.
Why don't you take a couple minutes and tell people who you are and what it is that you do so that they can get some idea from you as to what you're up to.
Sure. Well, primarily, as you know, I'm a serial entrepreneur, so I've started a lot of companies. Mm-hmm. Some have been very successful. Some have been not so successful. That's the life of an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. But several years ago, I got involved with Tritech. That's where I met you, in their small business development center, working with entrepreneurs, helping them groom themselves into a fundable company. Because, as we know, most startups and entrepreneurs have one idea of who they are and where they're going, and investors have a totally different idea of who they are and where they're going. So what we try and do is mesh those two and create a proposition that an investor would actually react positively to. And in addition to that, I've become the executive director of InsoCal Connect, and that is another organization, a nonprofit that's geared towards helping entrepreneurs grow their business through making connections with capital resources, with mentors. We have a structured mentorship program called Springboard that actually puts them through kind of a boot camp and really cleans up their business plan and tries to present a compelling model to investors. And then I work as a management consultant through Redtail Capital and Redtail Advisors, working with companies on fortifying their business plans, marketing communications, etc.
Okay, so yeah, it's interesting because in explaining what it is that you do, you've been on both sides of the fence. You've been the entrepreneur and you've been the person who's trying to get the entrepreneur to a point where they can get funded. When you're looking at entrepreneurs today, because I'm sure you see a lot of them, what are like the top three things that entrepreneurs should know that they should be doing that they're not doing that's really going to hold them back?
Well, a couple of the common areas I see is entrepreneurs don't think about what their intellectual property is and how they can protect it early enough. So a lot of times I'll talk to an entrepreneur and he'll say, I've come up with this great idea. Next thing you know, he's telling me all about his idea, and I find out he's told 20 other people. Mm-hmm. And the opportunity to protect that intellectual property is rapidly diminishing because he's basically publicly announcing mm-hmm. stuff that he should be protecting through some type of provisional patent or copyright, trademark, or having us sign an NDA, so at least it's a trade secret. Mm-hmm. That's one area that I see entrepreneurs take a major misstep. The other is actually having some kind of formal structure. A lot of times entrepreneurs go the sole proprietorship path, or they'll form an LLC when maybe they should have a corporation. They've mm-hmm. never really talked to legal counsel, and they'll actually get investors, usually the 4Fs, you know, mm-hmm. friends, family, and then you got the fools, of course. Right. But they're taking money without actually having any documentation in place, mm-hmm. and that provides a real problem for them when they get into due diligence with a real investor.
Yeah, most people, that they don't understand, if this is the first time that they've been doing this, when they go to their friends and their family, they try to put the most official document together as they possibly can. And they just assume it's going to be a throwaway. But as an investor, the next money in is going to say, what kind of agreements do you have in place? And guess what? That friends and family agreement that you labored over for 10 minutes and made to sound like a bigger story than it really was, now becomes the basis for all future investments. And people just don't think that that's going to happen.
Right.
What are you finding in terms of, one of the things you thought always drive me crazy is that people would come up with these stories and then you'd see their financials and their financials just didn't match the story. Is that something you see all the time also?
Yeah, and that's another big problem. So, you know, we have this springboard structured mentorship program, and mm-hmm. one of the things we're doing this coming week is we're doing what we call a finance panel. And we spend a lot of time with our clients talking about their financials, and we try and put together an accurate financial forecast as opposed to what we usually see, which is a bunch of numbers thrown together that mm-hmm. they like and they think is going to compel an investor to invest. And we walk them back through the entire process of creating a financial plan. But then what we do is put them in front of a panel of five or six seasoned CFOs and mm-hmm. professional investors to really go through their plan and punch all the holes in it before they actually talk to a check writer. And I think it's critical that entrepreneurs really take the time and the energy necessary to find credible mentors or advisors that can help them build a real financial model that a real professional investor would be interested in looking at further.
Yeah, actually, one thing that used to drive me crazy was I would hear these presentations where, you know, they're in a $2 billion market and they've got everything sewn up. They get intellectual property. They got the sales force. They got the best management team. And then when you'd see their, which I always believe, because usually around the end of the presentation, this financial review, income statement, and the results would be like $1 million the first year in sales, and then $3 million, then $5 million. And, you know, one of my first questions is, I don't understand what happened. You just described this, you know, you're going to be participating in a multi-billion dollar industry, and now your results, what happened? And more often than not, I would hear the word that would drive me up a wall, which was, well, somebody told me to take a conservative view of this. And it's like, I just get upset about that. And I tell people, whoever told you that, go back and, like, hit them. Because there's nothing conservative about early stage investments, and you're really doing yourself a disservice. Because if you tell me it's conservative, I make the opinion that you didn't do your homework. Because if you did your homework, you'd tell me what you really thought. And since I'm looking for a reason to say no, even if I got all the way to here, because you said that, I'm a no. I don't know who tells them to do that, but you know, you really should be giving somebody the best idea about what you think you can realistically do if they give you the money that you're looking for, that they're looking for. So
that's a great point, Jim. And I tell my clients that too, is don't worry about trying to make your financials look right to an investor. Mm-hmm. Make the financials look right to your business model.
Right. Yeah.
I see the same problem is they'll either go way too high because they want to attract an investor, or they'll go way too low, but they're not really looking at what they can really do. Here's the number of customers that we can get in these years. Here's how much they're going to pay, and this is how much revenue we can generate off that.
Yeah, I find that the other thing that's lacking is they're looking for a certain amount of money. And a lot of, so you'll say, so what are your uses of funds? And generally, when they tell you their uses of funds, it's about what they need over the next like 60 to 90 days. And it's like they don't get the idea that you should be raising somewhere between 18 and 24 months of cash. And you should be having enough money and enough things that you're doing that you build the value of the company such that when you go for your next round, the company is worth significantly more. Otherwise, you're going to go out and you're going to try to raise money and you're going to lose your shirt if you can even get it. And no one's really looking at that idea about what I'm really trying to do is this is how much money I need to get from here to a value of that so that when I look for the next money, I don't give 75% of the company away.
Right. I discuss the same thing. I always say plan towards milestones, significant milestones that will improve the value of your mm-hmm. company so that, you know, how much time and how much money is it going to take you to reach that specific milestone, whether it's getting a working prototype or getting a certain number of customers to validate the market and the fact that people will actually buy your product.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever your milestone is, you need to make sure that it's going to be something that moves the needle.
Right.
And you need enough cash to get there, and you need to be accurate in your use of proceeds so that you don't run out of cash, because I think we've both seen a number of companies hit the wall where they didn't get enough cash, they were making progress, and they end up going down the tube simply because they couldn't last, they couldn't run the race.
Yeah, they didn't ask for enough money, or they didn't meet their milestones. And I get these questions a lot, I hear that, a venture capitalist comes in and they just fire the management team. And my answer is, I'm only going to want to fire a management team if you're not doing what you said you're going to do. I mean, if you're making your milestones and you're doing what you said you're going to do and the company valuation is growing and everything's working, why would anybody want to replace you?
I'll tell you, Jim, what I tell investors when I'm pitching for myself is if I can't hit these milestones, I hope that you'll replace me.
Right.
Because I didn't do my job, and we need somebody in the job who will get it done because I'm a shareholder.
Yeah, actually, that's actually a really good way to be able to put it because, what people don't understand is that, that investor has a fiduciary responsibility to their limited partners to make sure that they do everything to make sure that the investment doesn't go away and it performs the way it's supposed to perform. So I think that one of the unfortunate things is that when people get these responses, they get it because they weren't looking for it. It's just in a conversation. Somebody mentioned it. And very few entrepreneurs will say, well, they replaced me because I didn't do my job. They stole the company away from me. They did this, they did that, because they're never going to admit that it was themselves. Very interesting.
It's not easy for an entrepreneur to do because most entrepreneurs are very self-confident to begin with.
Sure.
And unfortunately, a lot of times that'll bleed over into an inability to admit that they were wrong about an assumption, or they were unable to properly motivate their team, or they weren't able to sell to get that big contract that they needed to validate their model.
Yeah, I think that we all forget that when an entrepreneur is pitching somebody and is pitching an investor, one of the words that they've become very familiar with is no. You get told no a lot before generally somebody says yes. I remember reading about the husband and wife that started Cisco. They got told no 72 times before they walked into Sequoia and down Valentine said, oh, yeah, I'll fund you. I mean, so of course you're going to have this idea that, if you can do almost anything and it's all very positive. Because if you don't, the second or third time you get told no, you'll stop and you'll go try to do something else. So one of the other areas when you're in your Springboard program, is there a way that you're doing something to be able to evaluate the team?
Yeah, we assign a primary mentor who has industry experience, so we're kind of selective in who we choose as Springboard companies because we want to make sure that we do have an entrepreneur in residence who can mentor them that has the necessary experience in that industry. Mm-hmm. And then usually, since that mentor knows the industry, he knows the players in the industry, and he'll know if the team says that, say, for example, we're in the social media industry,
right,
and they bring in a bunch of guys, and we have a social media expert who's their mentor, and he doesn't recognize any of them, and none of the companies that they've worked for have ever done anything, then we know that we've got a major problem. In fact, it's interesting that you ask that, because I have a company right now that I just started talking with, and it's a husband and wife team. And they want to do something in a retail industry. And they're spending a lot of money right now and putting together a business plan and evaluating product samples and this and that. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, what experience do they have in this industry? And my friend who had introduced me to them said, well, they really don't have any industry experience, and they know they're going to need to have somebody in the industry in their company. And I said, no. They need to have some agreement with somebody in their industry that people will recognize before they start looking for investors.
Sure.
They didn't even think of that. They were just going to go out and say, well, we'll hire somebody if you give us money.
Well, yeah, actually, we have this at California Capital Partners, we have this this concept that we give a lot of emphasis on the management team because we try to think about it. We've seen thousands of companies. And we really haven't found too many companies or any that I could name that failed because the technology was bad. It's usually it's the founding team after, you know, a couple of years. One wants to pivot right, one wants to pivot left, the other one wants to go forward, and they just can't agree and they split up. So having this, you know, do you have the right level of people, or, you know, you've got somebody in there. One of our first questions to an entrepreneur as a founder is, do you think that you have to be the CEO of this company in order for it to be successful? If the answer is yes, and that's one of the first questions, mentally we've all shut off. We'll go through the rest of the presentation, but we've already said no, because that's one of the biggest issues. If you got somebody that's so psychotic that it's their being CEO is more important than the success of the company, you've already got a problem that's starting. So we give a lot of emphasis to the management team. So it's good that you got a process that you're being able to use to be able to ferret some of that out.
And the other thing I see, and we've both commented on it before, is when people put their pitch decks together and they start trying to contact investors and tell them about how great their company is, when they get to the management team, usually what they do is include a lot of past affiliations and stuff that really have no bearing on what they're going to do to drive this company forward. You really need to tell not so much who that person is, but why they're there.
Yeah, I actually used to see two types of things that drove me crazy. One of them was a list of names and titles, and that's all. And the other looked like a resume. And neither one of those are very effective. And I remember one time one of the companies saying to me, well, what exactly is it that you want to see? And I said, I want to see how each member of the management team, what exactly is it that they know or bring to the table about this industry, about this product, about this customer base that's going to make the company successful. And I do the same with an advisory group, because in an advisory group, you know, there are people that name drop, and name dropping, as an investor, you pick it up right away. What I want to know is, here's somebody that's coming there. What specifically do they bring to the table that the CEO absolutely needs in order to be successful? But the reason they're in an advisory position is, one, they don't have a full-time job for the person. The person won't work for anybody full-time. There's just a number of things about it that says that they really can only be in a temporary position. But I want to see what exactly is it that they bring to the table. And when I see these things that are like resume things, it's like you're expecting me, first of all, never make an investor work that much to read through and try to pick out what it is that you think is important, because we don't like to be put to work that way. There's too many other things to do. So I always like to see, like, crisply, so here's this person, this is who they are, this is what they did or their experience, and this is what's relevant, and this is what we need right now. So that's always useful, too.
So I had a good experience with a startup company recently. He's telling me about his team, and he said, and we've got this guy, and he named a big company up in Silicon Valley. And he's coming on board, and he just turned down a job offer for $600,000 a year to come work for me for free to help me build this company. Mm-hmm. So when you hear something like that, that's a powerful, powerful endorsement of your business model.
Right. Yeah, I think the other thing that I get to is not just an endorsement, but there's a certain level of credibility that you get if you convince somebody to give up something that would be pretty much a sure thing, because they think that there's more potential in coming and doing this for some period of time at no salary. So that, you know, the credibility that brings is actually pretty great also. That's good.
Yeah.
So what advice do you have? Because you're also on the other side. We have a few minutes left. So what would you tell investors that are like individual investors that are looking at some of these companies? What are the key things they should look for before they decide to even take their checkbook out of their pocket?
Well, you know, always I think investors don't give themselves enough credit for their gut instinct. And a lot of times when you meet a management team for the first time and they're pitching you, you usually get a pretty good feeling as to whether or not you think they're believable or not. And if the guy's talking too much, or if he's sweating, or if he's obviously nervous, you know, you can look past that if you can see the desire and commitment in them, because a lot of times entrepreneurs are nervous and they don't they stumble over their words, but they may have a dynamite product and they may have commitment from their team members. So first of all, I go with the gut instinct. The second thing is I would look at the quality of what they're presenting to you. If they haven't taken the time to build a quality executive summary or pitch deck, and they've got typos or misspellings, or like you say, their financials don't seem to be adding up, or they're just wrong. You know, you're not in the business of mentoring companies. You're in the business of investing in companies. Mm-hmm. And what you don't want to do is take on a full-time job by investing in a company and then trying to get your money out by helping them get out of the holes they keep digging themselves. So right. Really, you want to look at a turnkey opportunity as much as, yes, you want to help them. You want to share your Rolodex. You want to help them with some strategic options, but you don't want to become, you don't want to buy yourself a job.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really very good. It's really good advice also that I know that there are some people that they look at these companies and because I've had some conversations with some single investors who they're looking to see what their next job assignment is going to be, and they're looking to invest in a company to get a position in the company. That can be a disaster. Well, it looks like we are just about out of time and got about 30 seconds left. I really appreciate those great comments, and it sounds like you're doing some really interesting stuff. If anybody wants to get in touch with you, is there some way that they should do that?
Yeah, I'm at InSoCal Connect, and that's InSoCalConnect.org. My email is jgoth@InSoCalConnect.org if they want to send me an email. My phone number is 951-676-6509. People feel free to call me, contact me. If they're ever in the Temecula or Marietta area, give me a call and swing by. We've got an innovation center we're building in Marietta that's going to be pretty dynamite, and I'd love to walk people through.
Well, Jay, thanks, and thanks for coming on the show. Paul, it looks
Thank
like
you, Jim. I appreciate it.
Thanks. And Paul, it looks like it's time to go to a commercial, so why don't you take us there?
Why not? Let's give a shout-out to our sponsor for today's show, CalCap Partners. CalCap Partners is the manager of venture capital funds specializing in investing in small to medium-sized technology-based businesses with high growth potential. As such, they incorporate managers of previous investment transactions collectively exceeding $2 billion U.S. with successful outcomes since the 80s. They also have operations right here in the U.S., California, New York included, and Canada, Ontario, and British Columbia. And, of course, they have a global network of strategic resources consisting of managerial talent and capital resources that span the globe. So, if you're looking to get a partner for your business, why not look at the best? CalCap Partners. Simply visit their website, just like it sounds, CalCap. PARTNERS.com. CalCap Partners. All right, let's pick it back up. Back to Jim.
Why, thanks, Paul. And I'm glad to be here again. This is Jim Butts. I'm the host of this show. And I have with me one of my partners, John Nelson, again. We're going to spend some time talking about questions that have come in through the mailbag. So, John, you've got the list. Why don't you start us off with the first question? I guess it's from Dan Andrews.
Hi, Jim. Yeah. Well, we have questions this week that are some pretty big issues. I think a couple of these questions you could dedicate a whole segment to, so we'll have to try to limit ourselves a little bit. But Dan Andrews of Rancho Santa Fe, California, wrote an investor-related question. He says, I'm an investor that recently attended an investment conference where one of your CalCap colleagues, I think it was me, by the way, was a featured speaker. He had mentioned the timing of investments and their liquidations was important to building high rates of returns, but this process appears to be counterintuitive for many investors. I wanted to discuss this further with him, but there was such a long line of people waiting to talk with him that I didn't get to follow up. Please discuss this in more detail.
Well, since you were at the meeting, why don't you start answering it, and then I can jump in someplace along the way.
Dan, if you were at the meeting that I was at, of course, you can always write to me personally. You got my card there, I guess. But what I was referring to is fund managers typically like to manage an IRR, which is internal rate of return number that gets annualized, that shows how much effective interest or the investors have made in terms of capital gain on the money they put at risk in a fund. So that's an important metric to manage. One, how I did with this fund and how good is the manager. This has changed over the years. When I first got in the business, it was all IRRs, was all anybody ever talked about. And then somewhere around the late 80s, early 90s, it started going to multiples. So they say, well, I got four times my money in this fund, or I got six times, all the, you know, something X. So currently, most fund managers talk about getting a goal of some X multiple of your return. And I'm a bit old school. I still like IRR because one of my partners, not here on the West Coast, I'll say that, and I kind of get in frequent debates. He has some fantastic multiple returns, but some of those returns took 28 years to get.
Right.
So, you know, getting 100 times your money but taking 28 years to get it is a 6% annual rate of return. That's not that impressive, actually. It's nice that you made that money. Nothing wrong with that. But it's a lot different than getting a 40% IRR over 2 years.
Right.
So what IRR gives you is a measurement of return of capital against time. What a multiple gives you ignores time. The reason I give that prior discussion is it becomes important for a manager to stop the loss or the bleeding of capital that investors have given them to put to use. So it's incumbent upon the fund manager to try to put capital to work and return it as rapidly as possible. And the amount of capital that an investor puts into a fund is called the capital account. And I'm just going to give a simple example. If an investor puts in $1,000, their capital account is $1,000 to start. Once the it's like playing with your winnings. Once the fund manager returns that $1,000, the negative aspects, their money's returned. Everything from then on is positive against time. Where I've been an advisor or a venture partner in other funds that I haven't personally managed, my advice is always we need to do the investments that'll give us the fastest return first. Now, most young and technically oriented investors think just the opposite, because logically to them, they say, well, there's some very big deals, very important technologies we see, and it's going to take a while for the market to develop. We need to get in these now because it might take 8 or 9 or 10 years to get out of it, so we need to do that now. Well, the problem is they're playing a real risky game by doing that. I'm not saying you can't do any of those investments first, but you're best off playing with your winnings and taking your original seed capital, your principal, off the table and putting it back in your pocket. So that's what I was saying, what I meant to manage an IRR and a return. You have to do your short-term flips on investments first, and better to do two times your money in 2 years and do several of those and return your investors' capital to them. Then you have the next 8 years to build on that with bigger deals that take longer. Jim, that was a big answer.
Well, that's all right. Yeah, I think it was good. By the way, there's a couple other things that I would add to that, John. One of the things that doesn't really get talked about too much is that when a venture capital firm starts a fund, they do the same thing that an entrepreneur does, which is you put together a program that talks about what it is that you're going to do and how you're going to invest and what you're going to invest in. And you take it out and you position it with limited partners. And the limited partners like the plan, and it discusses everything. It discusses the management fees you're going to charge. And it's generally 10 years with the ability to extend it twice. But, you know, if you get to the point in time where it's like 14, 15 years, or you're a person on the East Coast that talked about having something for 28 years, it would never last in a venture firm that long, because if you get to the second extension and it's still there, you're obligated to just cut the stock up and give it to the venture firm and the limited partners in the amounts that they own. So that's the first thing that people just don't understand. as a venture fund, the management team's responsibility is not just to manage those funds, but also position the firm so that when they go to do their next fund, their next round raise, they've got some credibility. And the best way to have credibility is to say, well, okay, so given the money you've gotten in the past, how well did you do with it? If you did 3%, or you could have done the same amount if you put it in a checking account, nobody's going to want to give the venture firm money, and eventually the firm will go out of business. If you're putting together rates of return higher than what you could get from other types of investments, limited partners are going to want to do more and give you more money, which is healthier for the overall venture capital company itself.
Absolutely right.
Good. Okay.
Well, let me move on to the next question. Yep. That's sort of an investor related. Mm-hmm. This comes from actually an anonymous writer from Pacific Palisades, who says, I'm a member of a prominent California family whose wealth is earned mainly by our grandparents. Currently, I oversee many of the family's investments, both in funds and direct investments into companies. In one of your recent shows, I heard mention of a due diligence system that CalCap uses called SEMS.
Right.
That's not what it's called. I'll respond to that in a minute.
Yep.
And wanted to hear more about this and learn where such investment tools can be purchased.
They're not for sale.
I think the writer here was asking about our system called SEMS,
right,
which is capital S, capital E, capital I, capital M, capital S, which stands for Sourcing, Evaluating, Investing, and Monitoring System.
Right.
This was a homegrown system that actually I think the first version one was completed in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 30 years old. It's up to its 15th version now.
Right.
Quite a bit different than when it started.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that it's a database of about 300 questions or topics. Mm-hmm. That we cover to start with in due diligence. And the prospective investee only goes into it. It's oriented towards getting to know quickly. So it starts off with 7 questions. And unless the prospective investee, person wanting financing, gets all 7 of those questions with a positive score, they're provided a rejection letter. So, because due diligence is very expensive. So the first section is investing, and when that's ready, that's done. There's 300 data elements will be collected, and about 2/3 of them are quantitative, and about 1/3 is qualitative.
Right.
Then it goes into evaluating, and evaluating has to do with valuations of the company and looking at some other things like their IP estate, their intellectual property estate, freedoms to operate, and all those types of things. And it concludes with some beginning materials of a term sheet, taking us to basically preparing us, making us attorney ready to do a deal and an offer, or an offer and a deal. The next step is the monitoring, which personally, as a fund manager of many years, is one of my favorite parts of that system. And it accepts the financial personnel and other technology and other reports, sales reports, of the investee or portfolio companies, and basically benchmarks them against what the company said they were going to do versus what they did. So forecast versus actual.
Mm-hmm.
This is a variance report. It becomes a somewhat streamlined way of evaluating companies, and one of the real benefits I see within our own house is all of our reports end up looking alike, as opposed mm-hmm. to where I said I've been a venture partner in companies with the 15, 20 portfolio companies, and every income statement looks different. They're basically the same, but some information in different places, and you keep looking around, where's this stuff? One nice thing about this, it reformats it so everything's identical for us.
Cool.
It makes our work easier. So it gives us that data, and the monitoring system is to me the value for our side. And it does make it easier for our portfolio companies too, because they can just send these things through.
Mm-hmm.
So the other issue is there are consultants and service firms out there that offer similar types of systems, you know, sort of a turnkey system, or will develop for investors systems to do these types of things. At the time we did it, because we were a bit gray, haired, there weren't people doing this. So, you know, at one time we had had several international firms, including one country's Department of Treasury, asked to use this system, and we licensed it to them. We ultimately surrendered those licenses to them because we found this is a whole other business that competed with our investment business. Mm. You know, supporting and maintaining software is a business itself.
Yes.
And we decided we didn't want to be in that business. So we've turned down all future requests for copies of the system. So anyway, that's an answer. You either grow it yourself or you pay for it. Of systems, I get pitched all the time for people trying to sell me similar systems what we already have. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty expensive stuff. You know, feel free to follow up with me directly. Jim, do you have something to add about that?
Yeah, I think that the other thing that's important is, you know, when somebody says, well, where can I buy it? Well, first of all, it's a culmination of years of experience. So it's really the intellectual property that actually positions us within our business. And there are a number of times when people would say to us, well, how long is it going to take for me to get to a position of that I'll know that I'm getting an investment? And it's like, well, it could be anywhere from 30 days to 3 years. And what they don't understand is we have a process that we follow. The amount of time it takes, if we get everything that we ask for, because we're using the system, in a timely manner from the entrepreneur, it could have taken, when we were doing debt, it could have taken us, you know, less than 30 days in order to get to the point where we could actually make a decision on it. But invariably what happens is we ask for things and they don't get back to us, and, you know, it goes on and on and on. So having a process, if somebody wanted to have something like this, all they'd have to do is figure out what are all the steps that I'm going to do from the time that I talk to someone till I decide that there's enough here for me to make a decision to invest or not invest, and you write your steps down and you start following it, you can kind of create your own. Most people tend to not want to do that, and they don't think that they have time for it. And it is the basis, if you follow something like this, it sort of dovetails into why California Capital Partners could have a higher rate of return than average people.
Yeah, and the only other thing I want to say is that when we first developed this, you know, I was about half the age I am now, mm-hmm. and myself and some of the other younger partners were really looking for a magic bullet, something to give us a competitive edge and give us the right answers to pick the best deals. And we learned over time that I don't think we can write human judgment on software mm-hmm. quite the same as we dreamed. So along the way, the wisdom we've learned for using systems like this is it's a very good directive and piece of information that's used in a more qualitative sense. Right. So I'd say that I recall the company that scored the highest percentile on the total scoring of the system was one that we abandoned more or less at the altar. Mm-hmm. Because the other partner, as you know, in our firm, we have two partners, a lead and a backup, mm-hmm. second chair, like a yep. pilot, co-pilot on every deal. And I was the co-pilot on this deal, and the leading partner and I decided, despite the fact this company had the highest score ever, we just did not trust that CEO.
Right.
So we backed out just because we had a bad gut feeling, and yeah. it turned out that was good judgment because the company did go public, but it needed 10 times more capital than it said. Than it forecast to get there. And then once it got there, by the time it went out at $12, went quickly to 20, then dropped back to 12 and kept sinking all the way down to 3 cents. By the time we got our money out of it, we'd have lost money.
Sure.
So anyway, the point is we view it as a guide, and still our investment committee really makes the decision. As right. Jim said, it's a best, the best part is organizes the process
yep.
and organize the data so we know where we are, we know how the company is performing. It organizes each piece in the spectrum of investing in a standard way. And it gives us a common language inside and within our portfolios to communicate.
Yeah, so, yeah. I like the other part of it, John, too, that says that because you're looking at lots of different deals and you might have four or five things you're looking at the same time, it actually forces a level of consistency because it's really difficult if you have four things in front of you and you're looking at apples and oranges all the time. We're always looking at the same things. We're always looking at the same type of data. Clearly, the idea that everybody could score high, but it's this sitting there looking at somebody, looking at how they act and how they react, and giving you enough information so you can actually develop a gut instinct about whether or not you like this person or not is great. But I like the idea of having this consistency so that you can really evaluate things on a level playing field.
Yeah,
good.
Well, Jim, the next question is more of a entrepreneurial.
Sure.
Question or a business owner's question. I think it's one that you have lots of passion and feeling for.
Yeah.
It comes in from Joyce Cabello of Manhattan Beach, California. It says, I'd like to know what investors want to see to make investment decisions for a company like mine, a medical technology, he puts in parentheses.
Mm-hmm.
Some say that I need a one-page summary to start with, but others say PowerPoint slides are better. Then there's a business plan, the financial plan, the marketing plan, and more. Help! Give her some help, Jim.
So I'll give her some help. So there's a couple of things. First of all, the thing that you have to understand is, and I'm talking about dealing with venture capitalists as opposed to maybe dealing with an individual investor, a high net worth individual, or maybe an angel group. It's a process. In the beginning, what you really want to do is you really want to get the attention of your investor. By the way, you're going to probably need all of those things that you mentioned, but not at the beginning. You might as well have them there. Because it'll probably take somewhere between 4 and 7 meetings before you're going to get to a firm no or a term sheet if you're going to go that far. And there's basic things that you need. So you do need a one-pager that's really good. You do need a really good presentation, even though you may run into some investors that prefer not to have presentations. Someone would rather have you come into a conference room, sit down, and talk. But for those that need a presentation, you need it. The other thing you need is you need eventually the business plan, your marketing plan, your financial plan. As you go further along the chain of getting closer to the investment, the venture firm's going to want to see all those things. And the one thing that I would tell you from the beginning, you need to make sure that numbers and data are consistent on each of those documents. Because I've seen people to put it together that there's a set of numbers on a one-pager, there's another set of numbers in a pitch deck, and there's another set of numbers in an executive summary business plan, and they're not the same. And that's a known. You just don't want to do that. However,
that's a reason to say no.
I get the no right away when it's that way because it's really sloppy. And I've had actually people say to me, well, I'm changing the numbers based on meetings. And I said, okay, so what? Well, I had this meeting. I didn't have time. You didn't have time to make the information correct because you're talking to me about getting me to give you money, and you don't have the time to do that. What else did you have that was more important? So you get to know very quickly. There's actually a sort of red flag that comes up in this, though. Although all companies are the same, depending upon what industry, it sort of changes the landscape a bit. And there's this thing that comes in here, two words that basically says it's a medical technology. Now, I actually don't know what that means. I mean, I can conceive what a medical technology is. But what is it that you're really talking about? Are you talking about the fact that, you know, I don't know who Joyce is or what she was doing, but was she somewhere in a graduate school where she was in some sort of engineering or she was in some sort of a place where they were developing medical technologies? You know, until it's in something that can be sold, a venture capitalist is less interested in it because you got to get something to a point where you can have a business, grow the business, and have the business exit. And it's on the exit that everybody makes their money back. So I have a client that I work with, and actually we interviewed him a couple of weeks ago. His company's been around for, it's about 8 years. 7 years they were developing the technology. They were embellishing the technology. They did some basic products that could be used in a research or educational environment. And it's now the point in time where the technology's proven, they've got it, and now they're going to create a product around it. And that's a different story. Also, the term medical, there's one of the things that comes up that says, okay, so with this technology, are you going to be putting it into Does it have to go through any kind of FDA clearance? Do you need any things that you're going to have to do before you can even have the product sold? So there's lots of different things that come up in this space. As the investor, we want to know, how long is it going to be? What is it going to be? What's the market? How big is that market? What's your unfair competition that you have to sell your product? Who's your management team? All the elements have to be there, but you've got to come up with a story that's consistent that will allow you to get to do what you want to do, which is, for us, get a business, grow a business, and exit from the business.
Jim, I'd like to add just a couple other perspectives on your answer, because one thing is within our own firm at CalCap, each partner has their hot buttons. So while we have a consistent view in general, we want to see, you or Mark or Phil might want something slightly different up front.
Sure.
Yeah, you're expecting something slightly different. And the message there is, not only customize your preparation to the firm, in other words, do your due diligence to the firm and find out what it is they want to see, but try to understand who you're seeing at that firm and specifically what does that person want to see.
Yep.
And I would second what Jim says, that you're probably going to need all these things, but the first things out, I think, is you have to have, and the hardest thing you're going to do is an elevator pitch. Mm-hmm. And Jim has a couple of great stories in elevator pitches, I know, but you try to get what your opportunity is from the perspective of the investor, not holding your baby or your product up and saying, this is the cutest and it should win the pageant. Mm-hmm. You have to say, what's in it for the investor? And you have to communicate that. And I like to done in 20 seconds. Mm-hmm. Some people are more open. They'll say 30 seconds. I've even heard a minute. I'm the hard ass. I like 20 seconds. Mm-hmm. If you can stop me in my tracks enough to pique my interest for 20 seconds, and at the end say, I need to talk to you further. That's what an elevator pitch is.
Yeah.
Not saying I've developed the greatest technology and all I need is 1% of this huge market and we're all going to be rich. I don't believe you. Goodbye.
Yeah.
So that's number one. And then executive summary, some people are hard on one page. I don't care if it's two or three, but don't give me more than three.
Right.
That means you can't be concise.
Yes. Okay. And unfortunately, this has been going so fast that we're actually out of time. We'll have to get to the last question, and maybe we'll even extend this into our next conversation when we get to the mailbag. But I can't believe that we were talking greater than 22 minutes, but we have been.
Okay.
Well, so it's great talking to you again, John. Next time we'll get to the rest of these questions. And for any of you out there, please keep the questions coming. We enjoy them. Let us know what you think of them.
You've been listening to the only show that talks about the real-world examples, the real-life stories of venture capitalists today. It's the California Business Investing Hour, brought to you by CalCap Partners, right here in Orange County's only community radio station, octalkradio.net.